talking about the question of whether super selection rules in quantum theory are fundamental or not. So there's a notion, I would say the common notion out there, that super selection rules are axiomatic in a way. So a super selection rule basically says that the quantum state space is not completely accessible. Instead, it's divided into sectors, and all the observables and states have to be block diagonal relative to those sectors. So it's a statement that you can't access the full Hilbert space. There's a restriction for certain sorts of conserved quantities. So for some conserved quantities, you have selection rules. So atoms can only jump between certain levels when excited by electromagnetic field. A super selection rule applies for other conserved quantities like charge, baryon number, lepton number. That's where it's been proposed. And it says you cannot have coherent superpositions of different charge eigenstates. You can't have coherent superpositions of different baryon numbers, for example. So I'm going to challenge that conclusion, but I'm going to end with some open questions. And I'm going to start where sort of I got interested in this problem, which is sort of a version of this debate which arose in quantum optics in the late 90s. And it was sort of a controversy over whether lasers have coherence or not. So it started with this paper by a quantum optician by the name of Klaus Molmer in 1997. The title of the paper was Optical Coherence, a Convenient Fiction. And it started out by pointing off that, you know, everybody in quantum optics assumes that the quantum state of an electromagnetic field, in the case of a laser, so this is the field coming out of a cavity when it's lasing, should be a coherent state. So you're probably all familiar with the coherent state. It has a Poissonian distribution over number, but it's a coherent superposition over a different number, and so there can be a well-defined relative phase among those numbers. So that view basically says that coherence is fact. Lasers really are, do have coherence between different number eigenspaces. Now, what Molmer did is he said, well, let's think for a minute about how these laser fields are generated. Let's model the gain medium quantum mechanically. So he said, let's take the atoms in the gain medium, assign them a Hilbert space, assume uncontroversially that they're in an incoherent mixture of energy eigenstates. So there's some probability for any given atom that it's excited, some probability that's in the ground state, and assume energy conservation. And when you do that, if you look at a particular atom interacting with, say, oops, don't know why that happened. Oh, here we go. Maybe I should. Yeah, that's fine. Actually, I'm also going to turn off this. So if you look at a particular atom in the excited state, it interacts with the field, say a mode that has n photons in it, then all that happens under the energy-conserving interaction is that they become entangled, so that, you know, I have a coherent superposition now of excited n photons, de-excited n plus 1 photons. And of course, if I look at the reduced density operator of the electromagnetic field for this entangled state, it's an incoherent mixture of number eigenstates, no coherence between them. And you can extend the argument to, you know, what happens to the field when it interacts with all the atoms. Nothing really changes. And what you find is that the quantum state of the field is just an incoherent superposition of number eigenstates with a Poissonian distribution. So Molmer argued, you know, this is clearly what the laser field must be, and therefore the fact that everybody writes down that, well, it's a convenience. It helps make the calculations easy, but it's nothing more than that. In reality, this is the quantum state. And then people were kind of worked up about this, and they thought, oh, that can't be right. You know, we've used coherent states for so long. They really must be in coherent states. And so there's this long argument back and forth about which of these two views was right. Now, for the purpose of this talk, the relevance of this debate is that, you know, up here, where the camp that's arguing that coherence is fact, they're basically saying that the density operator is not block diagonal in the number eigenspaces, whereas the claim down here in this camp is that it is block diagonal. And so effectively what this camp is arguing is that there is a super selection rule for photon number. So the issue here is also one of the existence of a super selection rule. Now, in this back and forth arguments, I was sort of fighting with people about this at the time, and you know, everybody was taking different points of view on different days. Here, I'll just give you a little sample of how this argument goes. So the camp that says that coherence is fact pulls out this really nice argument. It says, look, let's stop arguing. Let's settle it with a measurement. If I can find a measurement that proves that the quantum state has coherent superposition over a different number of eigenspaces, then clearly I've won. And here's the measurement that does it. It's just a Homodyne measurement. So the system is going to be fed in through this port. Through this port is going to be fed just a classical local oscillator, which is just, you know, a strong electromagnetic field. You beat them against each other at a beam splitter, and then you look at the statistics here, and you measure the relative intensity. And when you model that measurement, you find it has this form. So it's trace of the density operator for the system. This beta is the electric field strength of your local oscillator, and this is the annihilation and creation operators for the field mode. So you immediately see that if you want to measure some interference, which means that delta I is not zero, it has to be that the trace of the density operator with the annihilation operator has to be non-zero. And that means that there has to be coherence between the different number eigenspaces. Because if it's diagonal in number, this will always be strictly zero. And of course, if you put in the coherent state and you work this out, you get what's observed in experiment. Yes?
Does it mean that the reference oscillator is a laser as well, or is it kind of a regular frequency?
Well, the assumption in this argument is that, yeah, it's a laser as well at the same frequency as the signal you're measuring. The argument would say, so, you know, Molmer must be wrong, because if I fed in also, you know, an incoherent mixture of number eigenstates on the local oscillator, well, I wouldn't see this either. But there's a nice response to it, which sort of touches on this question. So now I'll go to the camp that believe that coherence is fiction. And they say, well, if you go to the lab and you do this, or you read the papers that claim to have done this, what you'll find is that the experiment really looks like this. If you ask where did the signal and the local oscillator come from, the answer is they were phase locked together. They came from some common source, which, you know, was split at some highly unbalanced beam splitter, so that most of the intensity went into the local oscillator and some intensity went into the field, and then they were brought back together. And now if you analyze this experiment under the assumption that there's no coherence in the field mode, what you find is that the joint state of the reference and the system is now an incoherent mixture over different number eigenspaces of states which are entangled between the two modes here. So you know, this is just a sum over all the ways of distributing n photons between these two modes. That's what you get when you feed a Fock state into half of a beam splitter. I haven't written down the expression for these coefficients, but you get such an entangled state. And then you pass it through the phase shifter, and you get a phase factor here, which is basically a relative phase between the different ways of distributing those n photons between the two modes. And then when you ask, well, what's the expression for the relative intensity on these two ports? Well, because the reference mode is now treated quantum mechanically, I have an annihilation and creation operator for the reference mode. And so it turns out that this relative phase is sufficient to make this quantity non-zero, and you can reproduce the experimental observations perfectly. And now the point is that if I, again, look at what's the reduced density operator of the signal for this kind of quantum state, well, for each one of these components, it's just going to be a mixture of number eigenstates, and therefore it's going to be a mixture of number states overall. Therefore, there's no coherence. So both of these perspectives can seem to do justice to the experimental statistics. And this is what sort of happened for all the kind of experiments and considerations that people made. There was a lot of back and forth on this debate. And at the end of the day, roughly speaking, people realized, well, it turns out it doesn't really make a difference operationally for our calculations which of these two viewpoints you take. But there was a kind of dissatisfaction with the conceptual murkiness of this whole issue. You know, why is it? Shouldn't we be able to get to the bottom of this and settle whether it's one or the other? Now, the interesting thing is that, you know, this debate has happened over and over again in all sorts of different fields of physics. So once you sort of see the pattern, you realize that it's very common. So there was a similar debate on the question of whether you can violate a Bell inequality with a two-mode single photon state. In the context of Bose-Einstein condensation, people often write down the order parameter as the expectation value of the field operator for some mode. Now, if you believe in a baryon number superselection rule, that implies an atom number superselection rule. It implies that whatever the quantum state of the Bose-Einstein condensate is, it cannot be a superposition of different numbers of atoms. And therefore, the expectation value of the field operator should be strictly zero. And yet people use this, they write down wave functions that are coherent superpositions of different numbers of atoms, and they make pretty good predictions with that. So it's funny, the language here was very different. People often say, well, it's a convenient fiction. It's not really in this state, but we can do our calculations this way and not make any error. And then there are some who say, well, we shouldn't be writing down wave functions that we don't believe really exist. In superconductivity, it's the same thing, but for the charge superselection rule. So the BCS ground state is a coherent superposition of a different number of Cooper pairs. If you believe in a charge superselection rule, that shouldn't be possible. And therefore, you shouldn't be using that wave function, or you should be saying it's just a convenient fiction, and the real wave function is something else. And then if you go all the way back to the beginning, the first instance of this argument occurred shortly after the notion of a superselection rule was first proposed. And there's this famous paper by Haranov and Susskind where they argue that you can lift a superselection rule that is not fundamental. And roughly speaking, a lot of this talk is going to be about sort of making a modern quantum information theoretic version of Haranov and Susskind's argument and generalizing it.
So yes? What's wrong? If you go back to the previous slide, You've compared these two situations. But can you just make an experiment where you don't use the common source for the laser and the signal that you want to analyze? Can you do that?
So this is going to be part of my point. But if this person tried to do this experiment where this signal was not phase locked to this local oscillator, then you wouldn't see the interference. Because if every sample, the signal has a different overall phase, I'm not going to build up an interference pattern. So this person will sort of agree, yeah, they've got to be phase locked. And then this person says, well, if you want to make them phase locked, and if I want to treat this guy quantum mechanically, then I have to model it this way. So they're sort of agreed that the two things have to be phase locked. They're still just disagreeing over what the right way to represent that quantum mechanically is. But this is getting closer to the real issue. I'm basically, in the first part of this talk, going to be talking about this paper where my co-authors and I proposed a kind of conceptual resolution of this debate. And the idea is this, that effectively what's in the back of our heads when we're having this debate is a presumption that quantum states only contain information about the intrinsic properties of the system. So somehow it feels that there ought to be some matter of fact about whether the system has coherence or doesn't, and it sort of doesn't matter about anything else in the universe. It either does or it doesn't. But in fact, what I want to argue is that the quantum state of a system describes not only its intrinsic properties, but extrinsic properties as well. So relations of that system to other systems, in particular reference frames that are external to it. And then whether or not you should write down a coherent state depends on which external system you're describing the system relative to. And the two camps in this debate ultimately are just going to be disagreeing about what the right reference frame to describe the system relative to is. Let's get started. So first of all, simple question, what does it mean when I say I have a spin half particle and it's spin up in the z direction? Given that space is isotropic, I don't mean sort of in some absolute sense. What I really mean is that it's spinning up relative to a z-axis that's defined by some other physical system, such as maybe a set of gyroscopes that I have in my ship or in my lab that define the z-axis for me and essentially are acting as a Cartesian reference frame. That's what it means to assign a z-spin-up state. And similarly, if I have a particular mode and I want to assign a state that has a well-defined phase, that also means relative to some other physical system, such as some other oscillator that I have in my lab, which is acting as a phase reference. So that's the sense in which these phases and coherences, therefore, are going to be extrinsic properties of the system, not intrinsic. They're always the relation of that system to something else. So let me go back to the case of a rotational degree of freedom. So when I usually write down a quantum state on the Hilbert space of a spin half particle, what I mean is it describes the orientation of that system relative to some background frame, which I'm not treating quantum mechanically. It's just sort of there in the background implicitly. I just write down a single two-dimensional Hilbert space. But if I want, I could treat that reference frame quantum mechanically. I could assign it a Hilbert space. I'll call it HR. And I can assign a quantum state to these pairs of systems. And now this quantum state, which I've called sigma RS, describes the relation of this composite, again, to something in the background, right? So if sigma RS points in some direction in space, well, that means that it's pointing relative to some other reference frame. So when I choose to quantize my reference frame, I still have another reference frame in the background. And now here's the point, that if I take the reduced density operator on S of this state here, I get back to a quantum state on a two-dimensional Hilbert space. But now if I ask, well, what's it describing? It's describing the relation of S to R naught, not the relation of S to R. So even though I've got a quantum state on the same Hilbert space I had here, I'm describing a different degree of freedom. I'm describing the system relative to R naught, not the system relative to R. So it's entirely conceivable that these two quantum states could be different. They're describing different things. Is always what? Positive? Oh, possible. Yes, that's typically what we assume in quantum information, that, or I would say it's sort of a postulate of quantum mechanics, that composite systems are represented by the tensor product of their individual Hilbert spaces. Yes?
Such a tensor product composition of the total Hilbert space.
So what's an example of that?
For example, in H theory, this might not be possible. Suppose you're in bad space theory, the total Hilbert space, if you impose the gauge invariance, then the total Hilbert space might not be decomposable. And suppose you divide this, the total system into two regions, and then in that case, you might not have a tensor product composition of the total Hilbert space.
So I wonder if you could get around that. So for example, if I look at bosons, for instance, and I say, oh, well, the wave function has to be symmetrized, so I can't imagine that, say, two particles are not represented by the tensor product of this single particle Hilbert space and this single particle Hilbert space. You know, that might be considered another example. So in that case, I would just say, well, then go to second quantized notation. The degrees of freedom are now the modes, and I'm doing Fock spaces, and now the degrees of freedom of different modes do combine by tensor product. So I wonder if I could do something similar for the case you're interested in.
But isn't it enough to say that on top of the tensor product you would need to impose some constraints?
Yeah, it is.
Okay. Right. I mean, yeah, it's not absolutely general. It would be tensor product possibly with constraints.
So it would be not all states on the tensor product could be realized, but every state can be written in this way. Okay, so this is the general idea, and in particular, if the difference between these two reference frames is that this spin is well oriented relative to R, but actually R naught and R, you know, you as the physicist don't know how they're oriented relative to one another, so the orientation of R naught relative to S is totally unknown, then this state here is going to essentially be mixed over all rotations, and so it's going to be rotationally symmetric. And therefore, the reduced density operator in S is also going to be rotationally symmetric. And so that's a particular way in which these two quantum states could be different. This one could point, you know, up along Z, whereas this one would have to be completely mixed. OK, so let me go back to the optical coherence controversy. So the relationship with symmetries is this, that the camp that was pushing for a super selection rule for photon number was basically saying that the quantum state of this electromagnetic field is going to be symmetric under phase shifts, which is just another way of saying that a state which has coherence is one that is allowed to be asymmetric under phase shifts. So these are the phase shifts. They're just exponentiation of the number operator for my field mode. And so if I have something which obeys the superselection rule, then when I act this phase shift operation on it, it's invariant. Whereas if this were not the case, if there were some off diagonal elements here, then this invariance would fail. It's an if and only if. And so more generally, if I have any state and then I project it down into those number eigenspaces by this procedure, then I find it becomes invariant under phase shifts. And here's sort of an important point for the talk, which is that projecting down into the number eigenspaces, imposing the superselection rule, is obtained whenever you average over all phase shifts. So if I take any density operator, this is sometimes called the twirling operation, I twirl it over phase shifts, I'll get something that's photon number superselected and therefore invariant under phase shifts. Okay, so now if we come back to this original experiment, so I described it to you as, you know, a mixture of entangled states between these two modes, but this connection I just told you about here means that I can also write it as an integral over all phase shifts of a product of coherent states. So I can think of the pair of modes here as being in a product of coherent states, beta and alpha, but the overall global phase of those two, they're phase locked relative to one another, but the overall global phase is unknown. So that's my integral over theta. And then after it passes through the phase shifter, I just pick up a relative phase between these two modes. And that is why, you know, so this is just an equivalent way of writing down the same state I wrote before. And then maybe it's a bit more obvious how you can expect to get non-zero values here, because all this cares about is the relative phase between the two modes. And here, that's well-defined, even though the global phase is not. And of course, you know, if I just write down the density operator for S, I find that I just integrate over all phases, and that's why it's incoherent over number. So what it all means in terms of this original argument here is that if you decide to describe this mode relative to one reference frame, this oscillator with respect to which it's well-oriented, then you'll find that it's asymmetric relative to phase shifts. It has a well-defined phase relative to this oscillator. But if instead you decide to quantize this oscillator R, and you have another oscillator in the background R naught, and it happens that you don't know the phase of this guy relative to these, okay? Like, for example, that's what Molmer said when he talked about the atoms in the gain medium. He said, they don't have a well-defined phase, and I'm going to refer everything to them. So when you do that, you're now describing this composite relative to this background phase reference. Now, this whole thing is going to have to be in a phase-invariant state, because if it's described relative to one of these reference frames that I don't have, you know, a good correlation with, then it's going to be phase-invariant. And therefore, the state on S is going to be phase invariant as well. And so it's going to be different from this state here. And so that's what we saw. We had a phase non-invariant state, in this case, a coherent state. And over here, we had one that was symmetric under phase shifts, so it had this diagonal form. And so the idea is that both of these perspectives are perfectly good. The reason there was a discrepancy is because the two camps were differing in how they wanted to model the system. That's all. They were relating the system to a different reference frame. So roughly speaking, in the coherence's fact camp, they wanted to treat the reference frames that were correlated with the system as sort of external things that you're not quantizing. Whereas in this camp, whenever there was a reference frame that was correlated with a system, they wanted to quantize it. And the only things that they wanted to leave as external unquantized were reference frames that weren't correlated with the system. And if that's your position, then you'll always have this disagreement about whether it's coherent or not. Okay, so you might say, well, which fine, so it's just a difference in how we model the system, but what's the right way of modeling the system? You know, is it the coherence camp or the coherence's fiction camp that has it right? And so I first want to point out that this isn't something that's unique to quantum theory. So even in classical physics, we have situations where the physicist gets to choose what they model as internal dynamical degrees of freedom and what they leave as an external non-dynamical degree of freedom. So here's a simple example. If I have a ball bouncing off of a wall, then I could solve that problem by saying, oh, the wall is a potential, you know, maybe like an infinitely high potential, and I solve the equations of motion for the ball in the presence of that potential. Or if I want, I can say, no, the wall is another dynamical degree of freedom. I'm going to assign it a position. I'm going to solve the equations of the motion with the ball and the wall being coupled to one another, and the wall, if it's massive enough, won't suffer much of a back action. And I'll find that the solutions of the two problems give me exactly the same trajectory for the ball. And all that changes is how I've chosen to model the wall. Of course, in this sort of approach, you find that there's a failure of conservation of linear momentum. The ball, you know, changes its linear momentum. And there's also a failure of symmetry under translations. The set of solutions for the ball is not invariant under translation. So if I shift this trajectory over in space such that it's a trajectory that bounces off of nothing, that's obviously not a solution of the equations of motion anymore. And it's not surprising because this external potential breaks the spatial translation symmetry. Whereas if I do it this way over here, then I do have conservation of linear momentum and I do have symmetry under translations. Okay, so we often sort of talk about how, oh yes, these are fundamental and we must always assume these. But of course, if you're doing a problem in this sort of way where you're modeling external potentials, these properties don't hold. And that's effectively what's going on here. So on this side, when you're treating your reference oscillator as an external system, you can have a failure of conservation of photon number. So I can, in a down conversion experiment, for instance, I can, or in an antenna where I treat the field classically, I can generate photons. And the state of the system can be asymmetric under phase shifts. So I can have a failure of the photon number superselection rule. Whereas if I decide to treat this reference oscillator as a quantum system and assign it a Hilbert space, then I'll have conservation of photon number for this system, and I'll find that the state of the overall system is symmetric under phase shifts. So it's the same sort of thing. And the argument, the claim I want to make is that this is just a conventional choice. It's not as if one is right and the other's wrong. As long as your reference system is large enough, you won't make a mistake by treating it externally. And often you'll simplify your life. The Hilbert space you have to use will be much smaller. The problem you have to solve, the equations will be simpler. So it's often the right choice just for expediency. So what I want to do now is basically go back to my rotation example, just because it's sort of the easiest one to think about. But I actually want to do something quite general. I want to convince you that not only for this particular example I showed you of these optical interference experiments, but basically for any example of a symmetry group, if I have a description of a system relative to some reference frame for that symmetry group, and I'm treating the reference frame externally, I can describe everything about that system, all the experiments you might do on it, equally well in a framework wherein I quantize that reference frame. So I want to convince you of that, that this is always possible. And I'll use the rotation example to do it.
I have a question on that. So,
yes?
So you're saying both equally good, but I mean, didn't your example of the classical mechanics basically show that the bigger one, like the one where you include the wall, is sort of really truer or something? Like,
well,
I think everyone would agree in classical mechanics that's a more complete picture of the whole story or something.
I think most people do have that intuition here as well, that somehow, if, you know, it would be nice to quantize everything because that's, you know, better. But it depends on the notion of better. You know, maybe it might give you something more accurate, but maybe it'll make the calculation impossible, and in that case, it's not better. But also, let me say that often the effects that you see, like let's say the wall is not arbitrarily more massive than the ball, then you might see some back action effect. It is possible to model that in the system where the wall is external as a kind of anomalous acceleration, a fictitious force acting on the ball. And so it's not as if I don't have some recourse to capturing those extra features in the first framework. It's rather that I sort of first have to figure out maybe what they are in this framework and then switch back to the external framework. And we're going to find something similar here in the quantum context.
Is it correct to say that if I believe in momentum conservation, or if I choose to have this attitude where I take momentum conservation as a fact of nature, then for consistency in the quantum case, then I would believe in the conservation of particle number.
Yes.
That would be the consistent.
If you sort of want to be consistent in your views, then you should sort of say, I'm always going to quantize the reference frame, and then I'll have conservation laws across the board. And actually, my main criticism of the sort of standard viewpoint is going to be merely that it's inconsistent, that it's going to sort of treat some degrees of freedom differently from others. But it's sort of up to you how you want to treat them all. I'm just going to ask you to treat them consistently.
But then you are also saying that sometimes it might be advantageous to say, I don't care about conservation of momentum.
Yeah.
Because it gives me a simplified description. Right. And the same applied to quantum systems would be validation of particle number.
And so at the end, I'm going to talk about how I think that there's a sense in which we can lift the superselection rule for baryon number, and that it might make our calculations simpler. It might be the right sort of way to do it. Yes?
Can you think of like describing statistical mechanics in a canonical and grand canonical as being these two?
I don't think so, because to my mind, the difference between the canonical and the grand canonical ensemble has to do with whether your system is merely interacting with a heat bath or whether it's interacting with both a heat bath and a particle bath. And that strikes me as not a difference of sort of how I choose to model the system, but a difference in the real physical situation.
The point is, like, for instance, if you describe the BEC where you have like a similar problem, then you, like, for instance, in the grand canonical, then you can have exact expectation value of the field operator, which is non-zero naturally. But if you use the canonical one, you will always get zero, right? Which is very similar to what you were saying, right?
The grand canonical ensemble is still diagonal relative to the number eigenspaces. It'll have like a exponentiation of mu number operator. So that should still have zero expectation value for the field operator, because it doesn't have any off-diagonal elements in the number basis.
You're mentioning the case where the particle number is fixed in the whole system, versus where you can factor it less.
Yeah.
But still classical, right? Not including coherence. This considering the ability to have coherence between different particle numbers.
But what I was thinking about is the...
There's some analogy there, but it's...
No, because the condensate, like the, when you consider like a condensate state, then you say you have a finite psi dagger expectation value, right? And then...
But when we do that, usually we mean relative to particular ansatz about what the wave function of the condensate is. And that ansatz is that it's a coherent superposition of different numbers. So typically they'll make it like a coherent state, like it's a Poissonian distribution over a number, but it's also coherent across those numbers. And that's exactly what some people dispute. They say, hey, you can't do that. That violates baryon number superselection rule. That's just a fiction. And so I want to sort of argue that you kind of can do that as long as you sort of know what you're doing and you realize that it means that you're in the background, you have another condensate which is acting as a phase reference and you're treating it externally and classically. So basically, I want to try to define a map from density operators, states over in this picture, measurements in this picture, transformations in this picture, to states, measurements, and transformations in this picture, which are now invariant under the symmetry group. And I want to try to prove that all this experimental statistics I can get over in this picture can be reproduced by the new states and measurements over here exactly in the limit that my reference frame is large enough. So basically, the next bit is all about sort of showing you how you can construct that. And I'm going to try to do it in a sort of intuitive way. So imagine for a moment that this R naught was perfectly aligned with R. And I ask, well, what would I describe as the state of R and S in that case? Well, there'd be some state of R, I'll just call it this projector onto the E ket, which is well aligned relative to R naught, tensor the state for S. Because I know that the state for S relative to R was rho, and R is perfectly aligned with R naught. But now, if this guy is rotated relative to R, then I would just do a collective action of the rotation group on E and rho, and I would get this as the state of R and S relative to R naught. And now if I tell you that the orientation of R naught is unknown relative to R, by which I mean that it sort of could be any omega drawn from the Haar measure, then I assign a mixed state to this guy, which is an average over omega of this rotated state. And I'm just going to write that as the twirling map, right? So it's just the collective rotations acting on E tensor rho, normalized. So that's what my state is going to be in this new picture. Note that it's rotationally invariant, because I showed you earlier that any sort of averaging over whole group leaves you with a state that's rotationally invariant. Note that the reduced density operator on S is also rotationally invariant in this picture. So it's really going to be a different state from what we had over here. Now, what about the measurements? So what I want to do is map any old measurement here. So in general, that's going to be a positive operator valued measure. I want to map it to a new positive operator valued measure on the composite Hilbert space, R and S. And I want this thing to be rotationally invariant so that it obeys the superselection rule. It's basically being defined relative to something that's not oriented relative to R, so it should be rotationally symmetric. Can I do this? Can I find such a thing such that the statistics over here, trace rho ek, is reproduced by trace rho tilde ek tilde? That's what I need to do. And the answer is you can. And let me just take you through that. So imagine, again, that these guys were well aligned relative to one another. So I could come along to R and do a measurement of the covariant POVM, which is defined by the group orbit of this E state that I talked about earlier. So this is just the rotational orbit of E. That defines an overcomplete basis. I can define a measurement in terms of that. So that would sort of allow me to figure out how R is oriented relative to R naught. And then upon learning that, I could measure S the rotated version of the POVM I wanted to measure. So if this is the POVM I want to measure relative to R, then I know this is the POVM I should measure relative to R naught, because I know I've learned that omega is the orientation, the rotation of R naught to R. So this would allow me to implement the same measurement on S that I was implementing here. And now finally, if I don't know what this orientation is, then I have to average again over the rotation group. And so the effective POVM I'm measuring on the total system is now this one. And again, you see it's just the twirling operation acting on E tensor, this POVM. So this is the idea, that you take just some fiducial state for your reference, which is highly asymmetric under rotations. You tensor it with the states and the POVMs you're interested in earlier, and you twirl those. And it turns out that when you calculate trace of rho tilde e tilde k, you find that it's exactly this modulo, this super operator d, which is a kind of decoherence map. Okay, so I'm not going to take you through the calculation, but it sort of has, you just use the group covariance properties. It's not hard to show. So it's just a mixture of rotations on the system with this weighting factor, and this weighting factor tells me something about how asymmetric under rotations E is. So if a small rotation will take E to an orthogonal state, then it means that this thing falls off very quickly, which means that it's highly focused around the identity element of the group, which means that this whole decoherence map is very close to the identity map. And so in the limit that this reference frame is large, that's what happens. And in the limit that it's infinitely large, I get a precise equality between these two pictures. That's just like if in the limit that the wall's mass was arbitrarily large, I get exactly no back action, just like the external reference frame picture.
That means that the first measurement on R completely characterized the action.
Yes, that's right. So if you think about it in that measurement picture, if we're talking about a compact Lie group like rotations, then in order to be able to do a measurement that totally characterizes the orientation between two things, I would have to have that Hilbert space be infinite dimensional, because I need to have as many dimensions as the order of the group. So for any group, continuous group, it's going to have to be only in the limit of an infinite dimensional Hilbert space that you can achieve this.
Wow.
Right.
Right. So in that case, then you can reduce even coherence on the spin system.
Yes.
So that's your conclusion.
Yeah, you can sort of, in this picture, make exactly the same predictions as you'd made this picture. So this picture allows, for example, for measurements that are perfectly predictable. So I could prepare the spin exactly Z spin up in a pure state and then measure exactly the Z spin operator and get perfect predictability. If you have a finite size reference frames, you can never reproduce that perfect predictability. But in the limit that this R is infinite dimensional, you can. Now, realistically, none of our reference frames are infinite dimensional. But of course, it's also true that none of our experiments are perfectly predictable. Every state we prepare is always slightly mixed, and every measurement we do is slightly non-projective. And so there's no, really the fact that this is the correct version is not in conflict with anything we've observed.
What about the assumption that R is in a pure state E?
Oh, if I relax that, I'll also get a decoherence map. It's just that this will be something like trace of rho, or I don't know what to call it, trace of omega times this, and
it will be less sharp.
It'll just be less sharp, yeah. So yeah, in reality, these are never in pure states, and I'm just going to get a little bit more decoherence. This is sort of an effective decoherence due to the finite size of the reference frame. Yes?
Is there any way you could also make sort of discrete groups?
Yes, so in fact, it's quite a bit nicer for discrete symmetry groups, because then you can have a perfect representation. So if I had a discrete symmetry group acting on S, I could build a reference frame, and as long as its Hilbert space dimension was as large as the order of your group, then I could have a set of states that their orbit under that group were orthogonal states. And then effectively, measurements relative to this would perfectly reproduce the external reference frame picture. Yeah, so what I'm saying about this decoherence really only applies for continuous groups. I mean, you can use the same analysis. Like if your reference frame has a dimension that's only 2 and your group order is 10, you can say, well, I can still do it, but I suffer some decoherence. Okay, so let's, this is for unbounded size, the decoherence map goes to identity. Good. Let's look at an example. So to go back to the phase reference case where I have a reference oscillator, the system oscillator I'm interested in, some background oscillator that I'm describing these guys relative to. So this will now be my representation where this twirling is now a phase twirling. And this is what the decoherence map looks like. So let me write down a particular example of an E that does well. It's just a coherent superposition of number eigenstates from 0 to some number nr. And if I look at how sharply peaked this factor is, it's, for nr equal to 10, it's pretty sharp. And now when I calculate, well, what is the overall decoherence map, I get a very simple expression. It's nr over nr plus 1 times identity plus this small bit of twirling. So it's almost no decoherence. Most of the weight is an identity map, but you get this little admixture of complete decoherence, and it goes to 0 in the limit that the spread in number goes to infinity. All right.
So in this example, effectively, yes? You're treating the reference as a nr plus one dimensional.
That's right. So typically in the context of modes, we energy limitations mean we can't have an arbitrarily high occupation number. So that's what limits the dimensionality of space. Even though intrinsically it's infinite dimensional, practical limitations mean that we can only prepare finite dimensional states. And I should note that this is not the state that we're preparing R in this internalized reference frame picture where there's a superselection rule. This is the state of the composite of R and S, and this thing is still invariant under number because invariant under phase shifts because it's been twirled. Okay, so now let's go the other way. So I've just told you how to go from the picture wherein the reference frames are external to a picture wherein they're treated dynamically and internally. What about the other direction? What if I have a description wherein the reference frame is treated internally? Can I come up with a description wherein it's treated externally? And so, of course, classically, it's very easy to do this in this example. So if I had the equations of motion here for x wall and x ball, I would just take the difference. The position of the ball relative to the wall, x, is just x wall minus x ball. And that's exactly what the trajectory I should find in solving this problem. So I just define these relational coordinates to move from here to here. So that's effectively what we have to do in the quantum context, is somehow figure out the relational degrees of freedom. So we know that over here we're describing the relation of S to R, and that's not the same as describing the relation of S to R naught. That's what I sort of the point I made earlier. But there, somewhere in this Hilbert space of HR tensor HS, lives the relation between S and R. And if I could sort of carve up this product Hilbert space in a new way into kind of global and relational degrees of freedom, and then trace over the global and just be left with the relational, I should recover this description. And so this is not so unfamiliar to you in the context of talking about the hydrogen atom. So I could write down the wave function for the hydrogen atom in terms of the proton, the electron, Hilbert spaces. But if I want to know what do the orbitals look like, really I refactorize the Hilbert space into center of mass and relative degree of freedom, and I trace over the center of mass, and that's what the orbitals are. And so that's effectively what we're doing here, but it's slightly more complicated because we're talking about U1 groups and SO3 groups, not the standard Heisenberg-Weyl types of groups. So it's not just taking differences. So yeah, we want to do the same thing over here. Okay, so I'm not going to go into much of the details, but I'll give you the sort of basic idea. That if you ask where does the relation between R and S live in their joint Hilbert space, well, the first thing you can note, what you know about those relational degrees of freedom is that they are invariant under collective actions of the group. That's what defines them. If I do a collective action on the group on R and S, it's not going to change the relational degrees of freedom. So I take that as my definition. And then it just turns out that it's sort of an exercise in representation theory to figure out where they live in the Hilbert space. And the right way to describe where they live is it's not necessarily a factor space, as we had in the hydrogen atom. But in general, it's what quantum information theorists call a virtual subsystem, or sometimes called a decoherence-free subsystem or a noiseless subsystem. So the idea is this. You look at the collective representation of whatever group you're interested in on R and S. typically that collective representation is reducible. And then you express it, you figure out what structure the Hilbert space takes in terms of the irreducible representations. So it can always be broken up this way as a sum over a label for the irreducible representations, and then a representation space, which I'll call MQ, and a multiplicity space. So I could have written it as a sum, you know, with multiple copies of each irreducible representation, the number of copies being the multiplicity, but I'm just going to put that multiplicity in as a tensor product. And so when I act the collective action of the group, relative to this decomposition, it just acts here, and it completely decoheres in these spaces when I average over all group elements, and it does nothing on the multiplicity spaces. So the multiplicity spaces are where the relational degrees of freedom live. And so if I want to recover a relational description, what I do is I project into the Qs, I trace over the Ms, and I'm just left with a set of states living in the Ns. And that set of states is a representation of my original. That's sort of the external, recovering the external reference frame paradigm. So let's, again, let's take one sort of simple example of this, which is my phase example. Yes?
So then you're saying the Hilbert space, the relational Hilbert space on HIS is the direct sum of these parts?
Yeah, and maybe the right way to say it would be talk about the algebras of operators. So I can talk about the algebra of operators that lives just on the NQs and has no coherence between the Qs. So the relational degrees of freedom live in that algebra. And it turns out, what I can show you is that in the limit that my reference frame is very large, basically all these different Qs are just copies of the same algebra. They're all doing the same thing, except for the extremal ones. And that's where the decoherence comes from, that you don't always get a perfect representation. But you know, in the limit that that decoherence is small, you just get a single algebra acting on a Hilbert space. So, okay, what about the phase case? Well, there the group is U1. And we know that U1 only has one-dimensional irreducible representations, so these M's are all one-dimensional. But the multiplicity spaces are not one-dimensional. And so what it means is that I can think of the Hilbert space for R and S, in this case of these two modes, as just a direct sum over the multiplicity spaces. And so the relational degrees of freedom live in these multiplicity spaces. And so here's an example. If in the external reference frame paradigm, I'm talking about a system whose quantum state is just in the two-dimensional span of the vacuum and the one photon state, for instance, then in the internal reference frame picture, those degrees of freedom live in the multiplicity space, you know, in all the multiplicity spaces, but say the one with n photons. Well, there's an isomorphism between this 0, 1 space and the n0, n minus 1, 1 space. So any coherent superposition of these guys over in this picture is reproduced in this picture here, by this kind of entangled state in each of the multiplicity spaces. And the reason it's not a perfect representation when R is finite dimensional is that if I get down to n equal to 0, for instance, then I don't have an n minus 1 anymore, and I can't represent the state properly. And that's where the decoherence comes from. Those extremal spaces don't quite represent the state. Okay, so let's get on to how to lift superselection rules in the last little bit. So I've sort of told you how, in principle, I can mathematically define states and measurements which are symmetric and hence obey a superselection rule and reproduce all the experimental predictions of an experiment wherein the reference frame is external and superselection rules are lifted. But that doesn't mean I can necessarily prepare those kinds of states and measurements in practice. So how do we do this in practice? Well, often, for certain kinds of conservation laws, like angular momentum, linear momentum, energy, the sorts of systems that serve as reference frames are all around us. You know, we don't have to work hard to build them. So, if I don't have a reference frame for orientation, then I can't prepare anything that points in any direction, and therefore it's going to be diagonal with respect to angular momentum. It's going to be block diagonal in angular momentum. But if I do have a reference frame for orientation, just some matter that's not isotropic, then I can prepare systems that are well-oriented relative to it. That means I model those systems as being in coherent superpositions of different angular momenta. And similarly for linear momentum, when I have a spatial frame, basically any matter that's condensed into solid form, the fact that I can describe some system as well positioned relative to this one means that treating this reference frame externally, I represent this guy's quantum state as localized in space, translationally non-invariant, and therefore it's a coherent superposition of different linear momenta. So these sorts of typical conserved quantities, you know, every day we violate superselection rules for those, we always write down these coherent superpositions, and it's because we're always assuming that there's some reference frame in the background which we're treating classically. For energy, it's a clock, it's a reference frame for time. But if I take these other examples, so this is, if I want to violate the superselection rule for charge, one way to do it is to prepare one of these BCS ground states, which is, you know, coherent superposition of different number of Cooper pairs. And the argument is that what serves as a reference frame for those guys is a superconductor. Prior to superconductivity, there was just nothing hanging around that could act as a reference frame for the phase conjugate to number of Cooper pairs. But once you've achieved superconductivity, now you've got something relative to which another system can be said to have a well-defined phase. And similarly for atom number, it's a Bose-Einstein condensate that serves as your reference frame for the phase that's conjugate to atom number. All right, so let me just compare these two examples and show you how parallel they are. And this is basically going to be a proposal for how to lift the superselection rule for atom number. Okay, so you know, we want to know, how can I distinguish a coherent superposition from an incoherent superposition? And of course, the answer is going to be by doing an interference experiment. So we go back to the original interference experiment, which is a Ramsey interferometer. So the idea here is that I'm going to have a two-level atom. It's going to start in the ground state. And then when I hit it with a pi by 2 pulse, or a Ramsey pulse, it goes into a coherent superposition of ground state and excited state. Okay, so this, basically the Ramsey pulse is just tunes the frequency of the field to the energy gap of the atom for a short period of time. And then I let the atom evolve freely, but because the energy of the excited state and the ground state are different, it picks up a phase factor. And then I hit it with another Ramsey pulse, and that does a, you know, what the quantum informations theorists would call a Hadamard transformation back to the original basis. And so now I've encoded the phase factor in the relative weights of these two terms. And so if I just measure ground versus excited, and I find that those populations vary with the time delay between the two Ramsey pulses, then I verify that in between the two Ramsey pulses, it must be in a coherent superposition. Because if it were in an incoherent superposition, the phase shift would not have an effect and it wouldn't influence the statistics at the end. Okay, so that's how you verify you have a coherent superposition. You model the Ramsey pulse by, you know, this Hamiltonian term here. It's sort of impulsive. You let it act for this amount of time. In between, you're just acting a free Hamiltonian for the atom for a certain amount of time. And that's it. That's the experiment. So let me first note that if you insisted on quantizing the electromagnetic field in these cavities, if you said, no, this analysis is not right, we can't treat these as external potentials, we must quantize them, then this is the kind of analysis you'd have. You'd say, now, the Ramsey pulse, that same physical act of interacting these two, is now bottled by this Hamiltonian, which annihilates an excitation from the field in order to excite the atom from ground to excited, and here's the Hermitian conjugate. You would act it for this amount of time. And then what you would find, you could be in the coherence's fiction camp. You could say, right, the original state of the field in the cavity is just this incoherent superposition of number states. Or, you know, I could start it out as sort of the twirled version of this coherent state tensored with my atom. You know, that's what we saw earlier in the talk, that we could always have an incoherent representation using this. So this is my original state. And then every term in this sum under these Hamiltonians would evolve like this. So I start with the atom in ground state, cavity mode has n photons, it becomes entangled, then I pick up a phase factor for the different ways of distributing the energy between the atom and the photon, and then I do my second Ramsey pulse and it takes me back to this basis, and I again get the same predictions for what the relative probability of these two states would be. So the point is that even here in the Ramsey interference experiment, you could, if you wanted to, say, no, there's never a coherent superposition of the ground state and the excited state of the atom, because I've chosen to represent my reference frame quantum mechanically, and in that picture, I always have states that are diagonal relative to the energy eigenspaces. But I would say it's up to you. I mean, it's a choice of the physicist whether you want to do one or the other. You just have to be consistent with it. So now let's move on to the case of violating the superselection rule for atom number. So it's going to be exactly the same setup. I'm going to have two species of atom. So atom species 2 is going to be prepared in Bose-Einstein condensate, and species 1 is going to be made to interact with that condensate. This is time here. Interact with that condensate for a short time, such that it has some amplitude of forming a molecule of atom 1 and atom 2. And then there's going to be a relative phase induced, and then I'm going to interact it again with this, and I'm going to find what the relative probability of molecule and atom of type 1 are. And so the argument is that this is going to be, one way to analyze this experiment is going to be that I really have a coherent superposition of atom 1 and molecule in the time intervening, as long as I choose to model this Bose-Einstein condensate as an external reference frame. Okay. And of course, because you know the number of baryons in these two states are different, I'm not just violating the atom number superselection rule, but the baryon number superselection rule as well. So it's very natural. You instead of a Ramsey, your Ramsey type pulse is done through a Feshbach resonance, where you turn on a magnetic field such that the energy of atom one and atom two in their unbound state is equal to their energy in the bound state, and that allows me to annihilate one atom, one of species one, one atom of species two to generate a molecule. And then, you know, this is what the free Hamiltonian will be for those three modes. And of course, I can write that if I want in a way that makes it look more like the Ramsey experiment. So I define an atom state and a molecule state in the natural way. Then this and eliminating atom one and generating a molecule can be thought of as an operator that takes me from atom to molecule. And similarly, you know, the free Hamiltonian just captures the energy difference between the molecule and the atom state. And if you do it that way, you find that you can, I'm going to start by treating this condensate quantum mechanically. I can model the evolution of its initial state. So this is the state of the condensate. Atom starts out in, this mode starts out in the atom state. Every term evolves in sort of the standard way under these Hamiltonians. They become entangled. They pick up this relative phase factor. I can see interference at the end. So that's just a sort of standard picture of interference. This is how people would typically model the Bose-Einstein condensate. And now my point is, just as we had the two pictures for the Ramsey experiment, we can similarly have two pictures here. As long as these BECs are sort of in states with a large...
Do you know the clock of the meeting?
Oh, that clock is wrong. I've been looking at that clock the whole time. Sorry. Okay, let me wrap up. Sorry. So yeah, these as long as these condensates have large expectation value of number, like you know, for instance, they're in a twirled version of the coherent state, I can instead represent everything by just this one mode, atom molecule, and these are what the Hamiltonians look like. So I could just apply that prescription I told you about earlier. How do I extract the relational degrees of freedom? So here I'm describing the relation of this mode here to the BEC. I pull it all out of those virtual subsystems. And as long as this thing's big, it's well approximated by these kinds of Hamiltonians, and the evolution is well approximated by, you know, this sort of Ramsey evolution. So the claim here is just that these kinds of conserved quantities are not distinguished from these kinds of conserved quantities. Whether a superselection rule in any one of these cases applies or not depends on whether you choose to treat your reference frame quantum mechanically or classically. And if you want to lift a superselection rule for any given conserved quantity, all you have to do is make sure you have an appropriate reference frame. In some cases, that may be very easy. In other cases, it might require some technological innovation, right, which we have in these cases. So then the final point I'll leave you with is, what about the univalent superselection rule? So this is the superselection rule that forbids coherent superpositions of bosons and fermions. Is there a way of lifting that superselection rule? You know, might it be that, for example, a degenerate Fermi gas could be the reference frame relative to which those things are lifted? So you could do the same sort of setup, except now make species 1 and species 2 fermionic species of atoms. Then if you can prepare a coherent superposition of atom and molecule, well, the molecule is now a boson, so you've got a coherent superposition of a fermion and a boson. Now, the challenge is that, so there's extra challenges here. So let me go back to this case where I talked about defining phase references. I said, well, a good phase reference, one that would make this decoherence be very close to identity, would be one that has a large spread in number. But for fermions, if I have a single mode fermion, it can't have a large spread in number because of the Pauli exclusion principle. So I can't do it this way. However, I could prepare a multimode state, and then I could have a coherent superposition of, you know, just one fermion, two fermions, three fermions. So I could get that spread. But if I did that, then I could do Feshbach resonances, but the interaction cannot be just this simple one. Because as long as I just had a sum of terms like this, interacting with the fermionic modes in my degenerate gas, ultimately I would just be coupling to a single mode. There would just be one mode in that gas that I was looking at. So I need a different kind of interaction. So there's sort of some new ideas needed here. There are also some theoretical considerations that suggest maybe it should be impossible. So I don't know about this case, but if any of you are interested in trying to lift the univalent superselection rule and have some expertise on degenerate Fermi gases, I'd be interested in talking to you and seeing if we can do something like this. And let me leave you with the references. Why don't you go and I'll join you.